Kona Tribe is starting to poll its community members about a name change that could shorten or lengthen its name. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
The Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community is giving its 11,000 members at least 7 options to choose from.
Write-in option. Do you have a name you would like to see that is not an option listed?
The tribe has posted audio recordings with explanations both for and against each proposed option on a new website. But no action is supposed to be taken by the tribal council until next year. The new names under consideration are meant to help preserve Otham and Peeposh languages. One option is to leave the name as is. Other alternatives seek to replace the phrase community with nation to reflect the tribe's sovereignty.
Option 3. Salt River Otham Peeposh Nation.
While another variation adds Jervid, the Otham word for land.
Option 5. Onkakimir Otham Chalchalom Peeposh Jervid.
One of its sister four southern tribes, Thana Otham Nation, was once called the Papagos, a derogatory Spanish word linked to temporary beans. The tribe officially changed its name in 1986. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Ho-Chunk Inc. is addressing a labor shortage among young Winnebago tribal members in Nebraska, training them for jobs intended to help close a continuing housing shortage. It's part of the Legacy Learning Program, which passes on skills from one generation to the next. According to program officials, there's a lack of qualified young men in the Winnebago tribe to take the jobs that are needed the most. Ho-Chunk Inc.'s Janelle DeCora says the shortage is especially dire in the construction, carpentry, maintenance, and repair sectors, and adds that the students are learning more than hands-on skills.
Our legacy learning instructors aren't just teaching those entry-level workforce development skills, such as flooring, framing, those types of things, but also teaching life skills as well.
DeCora says the program has trained 3 cohorts of young men. 60% have found jobs in the construction sector. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 23rd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings and Josh Salem.
The producer is Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto.
Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Back to square one in the Ukraine war. The U.S. edges closer to direct intervention in Venezuela and the fragile Israel-Hamas ceasefire. First, back to square one in the Ukraine war. All it took to persuade Donald Trump not to provide Ukraine with Tomahawk long-range missiles was a call from Vladimir Putin. Trump said Putin wants peace talks, and that was enough for Trump to stand down on the Tomahawk idea. Trump acknowledged that he has been played before by Putin, but he expressed confidence that he always comes out on top. His decision is a big blow for President Zelensky of Ukraine, who had counted on the Tomahawks being available in time for the winter campaign. Asked if he was disappointed by Trump's decision, Zelensky said he was realistic. He knows not to count on Trump, in other words. Putin's notion of a peace offering is to trade two regions of eastern Ukraine that Russian forces partly occupy, Zaporizhia and Kherson, for total Russian control of the Donetsk region. In other words, Putin's concession is to exchange one occupied region of Ukraine for another. A total non-starter, as Putin surely knows. You would think that Trump would recognize, finally, that Putin simply cannot be moved to concede anything to Ukraine to get talks started. But Trump once again has refused to use any lever to push Putin into talking with Zelensky. To the contrary, according to an insider account in the Financial Times, Trump told Zelensky during their meeting in Washington he was losing the war, warning, quote, if Putin wants it, he will destroy you. At one point in the meeting with Zelensky, the U.S. president threw Ukraine's maps of the battlefield to one side. Trump said he was sick of seeing the map of the front line of Ukraine again and again. As I have said more than once, Trump could care less about battle lines and negotiating positions. He just wants to get rid of the problem. Right after his meeting with Zelensky, he said just that, quote, let both claim victory, let history decide. No more shooting, no more death, no more vast and unsustainable sums of money spent. This is a war that should never have started if I were president. And, Trump told reporters later, go by the battle line wherever it is or else it gets too complicated. Stop right now at the battle line. The Russians immediately rejected that idea, whereas Zelensky said it was a point for starting discussions. Since we're back to square one on stopping the Ukraine war, it's hard to see how another Trump-Putin summit, scheduled for Budapest, could have accomplished anything more than the last one in Alaska. The Russians evidently agreed. They put off that meeting, as well as preparatory meetings between Secretary of State Rubio and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Lavrov explained that the gap between the U.S. and Russia on ending the war is very large. Specifically, he said, quote, the root causes of the war were not being addressed, meaning, quote, ensuring Ukraine's non-aligned, non-nuclear status, which implies refraining from any attempts to draw Ukraine into NATO, unquote. This is quite a slap in the face for Trump, who had pushed hard for another summit and thought Putin had agreed to one. Next, the U.S. edges closer to direct intervention in Venezuela. A seventh U.S. attack on a Venezuelan boat allegedly transporting drugs indicates that the Trump administration is moving closer to a regime change policy. Besides the ongoing attacks on these boats, which have resulted in 29 deaths and two captives, we should consider, first, Trump's executive order, which he made public, to authorize CIA covert action in Venezuela. Second, Trump's comment that with control of the sea, quote, we are certainly looking at land now, unquote. Third, the abrupt resignation of Admiral Alvin Halsey, head of the U.S. Southern Command, who may well have protested against the legality of the boat attacks. And fourth, the deployment of 10,000 U.S. military personnel in the Caribbean, including a Marine Expeditionary Unit, 10 F-35 fighter jets, and a guided missile cruiser. All this is happening while Congress is being left in the dark. Efforts to bring the War Powers Act into force are underway, but with little likelihood of making it through Congress and Trump. The administration argues that the president already has the power to defend against drug trafficking, whereas the War Powers Act compels consultation with Congress and a 60-day limit on military action without congressional concurrence. The obvious concern here is that Trump is aiming at the overthrow of the Nicolas Maduro regime, directly or indirectly, via military pressure on Venezuela. Our third top story, the fragile Israel-Hamas ceasefire. 2 weeks into the so-called Trump peace plan, the only positive is Hamas's release of the 20 live hostages and most of the bodies of deceased hostages, and Israel's release of thousands of Palestinians imprisoned in Gaza. There is no sign, however, that Hamas will surrender its weapons or that Israel will stop attacking targets in Gaza. In fact, both Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump have threatened Hamas with extinction if they don't fully implement the ceasefire plan. But Hamas remains active, threatening and in some cases executing people who collaborated with the Israeli authorities. Two other obstacles to implementation of the peace plan are the tightening Israeli grip on the West Bank, with increasing settler violence intended to force Palestinians from their land, and the numerous Palestinians still in Israeli prisons in the West Bank and Jerusalem. One New York University professor who interviewed former Palestinian prisoners reports that, quote, as of early October, more than 11,000 Palestinians were still locked up in Israeli prisons, almost a third of them under so-called administrative detention, without charges or a trial, unquote. These prisoners, few of them involved in resistance activities, are said to have been subjected to all manner of abuses, which have been documented by United Nations agencies and human rights groups. In other news, a raw deal for North Korea in relations with Russia. The much-touted strategic partnership between Russia and North Korea may be greatly overrated, especially for North Korea. A report by a German think tank, the Friedrich Naumann Foundation, concludes that there is an unequal partnership between North Korea and Russia. North Korea has delivered up to $9.8 billion worth of weapons to Russia, as well as contributed around 15,000 fighters to Russia's war in Ukraine since 2023. North Korea has received relatively modest returns on its investment, mainly food, fuel, and air defense systems, with a value estimated at anywhere from $457 million to $1.19 billion. The Russians are effusive in their rhetoric about relations with North Korea. Dmitry Medvedev, the former Russian president and now deputy chairman of the Security Council, said on a visit to the North a week ago, quote, our countries are united in their efforts to counter Western threats and to forge a truly just world order, unquote. He emphasized that the bilateral relationship between Russia and North Korea has reached an unprecedented level of strategic partnership. Medvedev also expressed gratitude to Pyongyang for its support of Russians fighting in the Kursk region. One wonders if Kim Jong-un feels similarly grateful. China's declining birth rate could be a major problem. Emma Zhang, a sociologist at Yale University, writes, quote, China's birth rate has fallen from 2.5 births per woman in 1990 to just one birth per woman in 2023. The country's declining birth rate is not only an economic problem, but a cultural one. For many young people, the real barrier is not the cost of raising children. Rather, it is the conviction that parenthood no longer makes sense, she writes, in a future that feels uncertain and unworthy of investment. Unless policies address this deeper malaise, subsidies and bonuses will do little to stem the decline, unquote. This uncertainty comes despite substantial government efforts to promote more childbirths, including tax breaks, housing incentives, and childcare subsidies. For some young people, the incentives aren't enough to overcome the high cost of living and grueling work schedules. For others, no incentives are enough to overcome what the writer calls disillusionment, which has fueled cultural currents such as the lying flat movement in which young people stay home, and viral slogans such as no marriage, no kids, stay safe, capturing a broader retreat from certain ambitions, family life, and social expectations. Next, major Chinese advances in solar power and robotics. China has installed a solar field as big as Chicago in the western desert, 167 square miles of solar panels, enough to power the entire Tibetan plateau. It's all part of a major push by the Chinese government to expand clean energy sixfold, including huge solar fields in the west and wind farms just about everywhere. On robotics, China displayed its advances in humanoid robotics at a World Humanoid Robotics Games in Beijing. Two Google experts assessed China's work this way, quote, though the United States still has distinct advantages in software, advanced AI chips, and foundational research, China leads in robot hardware, deployment, and policy support. Last year, China installed nearly 300,000 robots in its factories, more than the rest of the world combined. More than half were made domestically. The United States installed only 34,000 robots, with most of these imported from Japan and Europe. The reasons for this spectacular advantage are horizontal and vertical integration of robot production, designed to make full use of the global supply chain and closeness of research and production facilities. Yet just the other day, internal documents from Amazon reveal that it plans to remake 75% of its workforce in coming years with robots, saving money by not hiring around 600,000 people it otherwise would have hired. By one estimate, the world by 2050 will be populated with around 650 million humanoid robots. These two authors from Google point out that for the U.S. to compete with China, it will need to, quote, double down on its strengths in ways that could prove difficult in this turbulent political moment. University-driven fundamental research, immigration policies that welcome the best talent from abroad, and a vibrant entrepreneurship ecosystem that's not mired in regulatory hurdles. Trump threatens Colombia. One of the U.S. boat attacks in September killed a Colombian fisherman not involved in the drug trade. Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, said the man's distress signal was ignored, and he demanded an explanation. Trump went into attack mode, accusing Petro of being, quote, an illegal drug dealer and, quote, a low-rated and very unpopular leader with a fresh mouth toward America. Better close up these killing fields immediately, or the United States will close them up for him and it won't be done nicely. Trump announced that the U.S. is ending all aid to Colombia and will impose new tariffs unless Colombia stops the drug production. It can hardly be coincidental that the U.S. then attacked a boat off the Colombian Pacific coast, killing two or three, the eighth such attack and the first in the Pacific Ocean. As with the attacks on the Venezuelan boats, the administration offered no evidence of drug trafficking. Next, myths about U.S. tariff revenue. President Trump keeps claiming that the huge influx of tariff revenue will enable the administration to support suffering farmers and anyone else who might be disadvantaged by his trade policies. But the reality is that the tariff revenues, currently around $200 billion, is like any other government income. It goes into the U.S. Treasury, and only Congress can allocate it. So far, not $1 of the tariff revenues has been used for military paychecks, low-income mothers, and other federal programs affected by the shutdown. Contrary to the administration's claims, those payments are being funded from existing budgets, not tariff revenue. So when Trump tells American farmers being hurt by immigration policy and China's boycotts of soybeans that, quote, we're going to make sure that our farmers are in great shape because we're taking in a lot of money, he's doing his usual boasting, nothing more. Finally, the racially tinged U.S. refugee policy. Donald Trump has a unique plan for refugee admissions, whites only. According to documents reviewed by the Washington Post, annual admissions will be only 7,500, and 7,000 of those will be white South Africans. The rest will be chosen because they can speak English or have preferred views of free speech. I guess give us your tired, your poor is out, and blatant racism is in. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertoff. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Terrence Burns. Joining us in the studio today are Michelle Manning and Vera Lewis from the African American Alliance for Home Ownership. We'll be talking about their upcoming home ownership fair this evening. Michelle and Vera, thank you so much for joining us. First, would you like to introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Hi, thanks for having us. My name is Vera Lewis, and I am the executive assistant to Ms. Cheryl Roberts, and I'm also a HUD-certified housing counselor.
Hi, my name is Michelle Manning, and I'm also a HUD-certified housing counselor over at, we call it AAH, African American Alliance for Home Ownership.
The African American Alliance for Home Ownership was founded in Portland. What inspired its founding?
So some local businesses and government and nonprofit leaders saw that there was injustice in housing and equity injustice among African Americans in throughout our history and more particularly in Portland. And so they saw the need to do something about that, and that's how AAH was formed.
Yeah. And I'll just kind of add on to that originally we just started as hosting these community fairs, homeownership fairs, to get information out to the Black community in Portland, because information was one of the big things that was being restricted. People didn't even know what processes to follow to buy a home, and really didn't understand what their rights were as they were going through the homeownership process. So we started with these community fairs and have just grown exponentially since then.
Here's another thing that I thought was interesting about your work being so important, that Black Oregonians were historically displaced from the Albina neighborhood and also displaced by the Vanport floods. How does that fit in with your organization?
Yeah. Vera, do you want to take that? Or?
Well, we work with anyone, but African Americans and other underserved individuals are our primary focus. We like to see them in those neighborhoods where they've been displaced. And we try to focus on that. Again, though, it is up to the clients where they want to live, of course. But we do, you know, if they want to be in those displaced neighborhoods, then we try to work with them to make that happen.
Yeah, and something that we do a lot is partnering with government bodies. And so City of Portland has a program to provide financial assistance to help folks who have been displaced from North and Northeast Portland, specifically the Albina area, but kind of broadly North and Northeast. And so folks go through a process with the city and apply and kind of show documentation that their family has been displaced, and then they can receive some significant financial assistance to make up for the generational wealth that was essentially stripped from their families when they were displaced.
Another question. What successes are you most proud of at your organization? Either of you can answer.
Yeah, I can jump in. As I mentioned earlier, we started with the fairs, and it was really community driven, and that was a huge reason why AAH has continued to grow and succeed, because it really had the backing of the community. But we've grown a lot since then, and we do we have a whole spectrum of programs, not just the homeownership counseling and getting folks into their first homes, but now we have tons of programs for homeowners who may want to pursue solar energy for their homes or do other types of energy efficiency upgrades. We have a program for folks to set up a will and estate plan so that they can make sure that legally everything is in place for them to pass on this huge asset of home ownership. So we have a whole slew of things that we provide now that were, I think, just maybe not even on Cheryl Roberts' mind at the very beginning, but 25 plus years later, here we are.
There's a little question that relates to that. Is home ownership easier or harder now, or somewhere between?
That's a great question.
I would say that it's It's harder in the sense of there's a huge gap in affordability. Mm-hmm. And so we try to work to fill that gap with different funds that we receive. Mm-hmm. But I would say yes in that sense.
Yeah, I would agree.
Wanted to ask, what successes are you most proud of at your organization?
Yeah. I mean, I think as a housing counselor, there are a lot of clients. I'm not going to name names for privacy purposes, but thinking about some of the families that we've worked with, so many of them come in the door really feeling like, is this even possible? Like, is this silly of me to even take this step? And once we start breaking down the process and working with them, I think, one, they start to realize how big of a process buying a home is, but then they start to realize, yes, they can do this. And a lot of them do need assistance, guidance, maybe financial assistance. But when we start putting those pieces together, there have been some families that I think we truly saved from being at risk of houselessness because they were renting and just in these really unstable situations. And now they're homeowners with a very affordable mortgage, and they're in a great spot for their families to thrive.
Do you guys teach people about the paperwork and all the things that they have to do in order to buy a house?
Oh, yes.
That's got to be the scariest part.
And then, I'd just like to add to, not only do we help them, you know, as Michelle was kind of touching on our programs, but it's not just about getting them into a home. And we also help them retain, maintain, and sustain the home through the programs that she just mentioned. So we really are, think of us as a one-stop shop of all things home ownership.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
What changes would you like to see in the future?
Ooh.
I'd like to see more funding.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, I think we've grown a lot in recent years, like in terms of number of staff and things like that and our capacity. But still, I mean, on a daily basis, our mighty staff of like 10, we all wear multiple hats and are running multiple programs. So I think, yeah, if we could secure more funding that would allow us to you know, serve more folks, that would be huge.
Your home ownership fair is coming up. What can people expect, and what kind of things can people learn at the fair?
Yeah. Vera, do you want to start? You want me to jump in on that?
I'll start. I would say that they can expect to potential homeowners and homeowners they will have access to lenders, realtors, and everything in between. There's workshops. There's even a kids' space.
Nice.
Good music.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, cool.
We have a great DJ.
Yeah.
And I think also it's not just for people looking to buy their first home, but current homeowners as well. We will have folks talking about, you know, if you want to do energy efficiency upgrades, mm-hmm. we'll have vendors that work with that, nonprofits and for-profits. We'll have the Portland Tool Libraries represented, which a lot of people don't know about, but they are a free resource where you can check out tools.
Oh.
So, you know, if you're buying a home and then you now have a yard to take care of, you may not have the funds immediately to go buy a lawnmower and a trimmer and all the things, but the tool library is a great resource. So we're going to have lots of things like that for both renters looking to buy their first home, but also homeowners.
Wow, that's great. It sounds really educational and something that seems like everyone should attend.
Yes.
Where will it be? Where is the fair?
It will be at the Doubletree, at Lloyd Center Doubletree on Saturday, October 25th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Yes.
Free parking. Free parking.
Oh,
free
hooray.
Parking. And the event is free as well.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's even better.
Yes. Yep.
Where can people find more information about the event?
Folks can just go to our website, which is www.aw, so that's 3 A's, then an H, .org. And there's a big banner at the top that says Homeownership Fair.
Well, I wanted to thank you both for coming in today, and that was a really good advertisement and plug for this event, which is really important, and as many people that could attend should. How could you lose by coming?
Right, and we're going to have raffles, so come for the raffles.
Hooray. Well, I guess I just want to thank you both for talking with us today. You've been listening to KABU News in Depth. The African American Alliance for Home Ownership Fair is coming up on October 25th at 1000 Northeast Multnomah Street. More information is online at ayaah.org. I'm Terrence Burns, and stay tuned. Did it.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KABU.